All right, so we're going to pick up in Genesis chapter 30, but what I'll ask before we get into 30 is if someone would like to recap the last episode of The Family of Promise, when we last met in Genesis chapter 29, what was going on there? There's no way you forgot last Wednesday, trust me.
Jacob was fleeing Esau and came to Laban's land and married Leah and Rachel.
That's right.
Started having kids.
That's right. So if we roll back even to the chapter prior to that, we see that there's concern on the part of Rebekah that something bad's going to happen to Jacob because Esau is furious because of the fact that he tricked him out of the blessing. And now Jacob has received the blessing from his father. There's no going back from that. And so Isaac and Rebekah agree that the best thing right now for the family is to send Jacob away to her brother. And that along with that, hopefully Jacob will find a nice young lady to marry. And little do they know, he's going to find not just one, but two. so that's what we see happen in that last chapter. Something significant happens to Jacob, though, on the way as he gets started out on that trip. What do we see happen there? I don't want to give too much away. I almost said it, but
the vision of the staircase or ladder reaching to heaven and the angels of God ascending and descending, and God promising that just as I was with Abraham and Isaac, I will be with you.
That's right. Yeah, if you see me like this, it's because I'm trying to peek around the laptop. I'm too short for this. Exactly right. So, and what do we talk about the significance of that being? I mean, it seems like many people might have various interpretations of Jacob's ladder or the staircase. It really doesn't matter. The only thing that matters is the fact that there was some mechanism for the angels of God to come and go, essentially. And what do we talk about the significance of that, that vision? Yeah, that's right. The angels are involved. Really, the angels just being an extension of God at work on earth, I think, is really what it amounts to. Yes?
Yeah, I was just going to say, my feeling had always been that it shows that there is a pathway for people who live on earth to somehow approach God. That it's there. Mm-hmm. They just have to do it God's way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that certainly is true. There's only one way to get to God. That is the way that he has devised. In this instance, there seems to be a very practical matter that's being explained in this vision. I think, you know, the ladder staircase is not inconsequential, you know, in the context of the vision here, which is God reiterating his promise to Jacob, which is very similar to what he's already restated for Isaac and what he initially told Abraham. And that, to go hand in hand with that promise, is to impress upon Jacob the fact that God is at work on the earth. And I think that that's significant, not just for Jacob, but as we talked about, it's significant for us. And really, I think that God is giving Jacob insight into the way that he operates that it seems Jacob didn't have previously. Jacob seems to have an epiphany when he wakes up from this vision. He says, I never knew. God is in the land, and I never knew it. And which we could argue, what, did Isaac never have this conversation with his son? did he never hear about the incredible stories about his grandfather? Like, it would seem inconceivable that he hadn't, but certainly he had never been, it seems, approached by God in the way that he did in this vision. So there does seem to be taking it to that next level. So even though, you know, even the conversations that my parents had with me or you have with your children, you say, listen, things are this way. Well, they never really seem to comprehend that until they experience it for themselves, and it could very well be that that's the case here.
I can kind of sympathize with them because if I were alive during Jesus' time and he told me he could do anything, but then he walked on the water, you can do that too.
Right.
Even though he had already told me he could do anything.
Right. Seeing is believing. I mean, the reality is that's just within our nature. Ideally, and what the scriptures really kind of draw us to is to really allow our faith to carry us, and yet we oftentimes are just drawn to the fact that we need to see it to really believe it. And it could very well be that that's an element of the story here with Jacob. But nonetheless, you know, I think that that vision is meant to be interpreted quite simply, I think. You know, it's not, you know, some, I think, outlandish sort of point that God is trying to convey through this vision, but rather to say, Jacob, I'm with you. I'm at work, and I'm going to bless you. And we're going to see that play out now in chapter 30 as well, because I think that while there certainly is an element of this chapter that is just people being people, I think there is a strong element of God's providence in the story that we're going to read here in Genesis chapter 30. And in fact, we're going to peek a little bit at chapter 31 just to kind of draw in some of that insight, because I think we'll see that play out later in the story more specifically. So anything that I say, I don't think is going to be a stretch of my imagination, but I think it's really just going to be pulling some points that will be made a little bit later on that allude to what we're going to talk about this morning. All right, so when we get into chapter 30, we talked about the story with Jacob. We won't rehash that because we're going to get into some more of kind of the back and forth between Jacob and Laban this morning. But certainly, you know, Jacob was committed to Rachel. I mean, he really wanted Rachel so much so that he was willing to work 14 years for her. Although what we see in the story and just the timeline of events is really only had to wait 7 years and 1 week to receive her as his wife, only after the week of marriage with Leah, her older sister, and that's an important detail within the story. That's the only reason Laban wasn't willing to give his younger daughter, because the older had to be married first, which seemed to be the practice, at least that's the way Laban explains himself. And so what we saw there in the last part of the prior chapter was Leah bearing sons for Jacob. And there's some significance in that, in the sense that even though Jacob loved Rachel more, it seemed that God recognized that. And because Leah was kind of forgotten, let's say, or neglected, and although that might be somewhat of an overstatement maybe of the situation, that she bore sons for Jacob. Those first four being who? Yeah, Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah. You might be singing the song in your head or something. I don't know. But and what did we talk about that there at the very end of the class? It was kind of the point that we left with. Happens to be the kind of the last thing that the chapter leaves us with. But yeah, I can hear. it's Levi and Judah. Judah particularly, the last son that we see born to Leah, of the first four sons that are born to Jacob, having particular importance within the remainder of the story, right? As we read the rest of the scriptures, in Judah being really the son of promise that ultimately will bear, a line of kings. And ultimately what we'll see the significance there being is in Jesus. That'll come later on. But certainly, we'll see the significance of the story as it pertains to Judah more in the near term, but in the longer term, that is the way in which God will bring about his plan. All right, so when we get into, and we talked about this, that at the time, at this time of the world, in this part of the world, wives seem to place a lot of their self-worth in their ability to bear sons or children, but I think probably importantly sons to carry on the lineage of the family. And that seems to be borne out in some of these stories that we've already read, where there's this competition, I think. Tom, you might have alluded to it as the baby race.
The great baby race.
give us some grace in that term. But what we're going to see is this escalate within chapter 30, right? So we start out with Leah, I don't think inconsequentially being Jacob's first wife. And I don't mean that in any sort of derogatory sense. She was literally his first wife. Bearing those first four children. And then what happens as we get into the early part of chapter 30? She stops bearing, and how does her... What is the attitude of her younger sister at this point? What does it tell us?
She's getting jealous and desperate.
Jealous and desperate, okay. That desperate is a bit of an editorial comment, but point taken. But we do know that she is jealous. The scriptures state that quite plainly, that she had become jealous of her sister, who was barren, despite the fact that I'm sure Rachel knew that she was the one that Jacob loved more. After all, he worked an additional 7 years just to have her. And it's not like Jacob even thought twice about it. At least we don't get a sense that when Laban came and said, no, you're going to have to work another 7 years, Jacob wasn't like, let me go and think about that. He's like, okay, let's do it. Be here another 7 years. So it seems probably plain that she knew Jacob's feelings towards her, but yet she had not been able to bear children to this point, becomes jealous. And what is her solution to this problem? Yeah, right, her maid, Bilhah. And her maid does conceive twice, right? Two sons. Yep.
But it is interesting how it was, how that was landed upon as a solution, and I think that's where the desperation comes from. Mm-hmm. When you look at verse 2, Jacob's anger was kindled against Rachel, right? He was upset with her, and why aren't you giving me any kids? And, you know, like, you know, she's at the position where, well, I've got to solve this somehow.
Yeah, so to highlight the actual exchange between the two of them, Rachel seems to be, at least her tone with Jacob, seems to be accusatory in some sense. You know, why haven't you given me any children? And his response is what to that?
Am I not always in God?
Yeah, who am I?
it's not.
Right, yeah, this is a complicated family, for certain, right? And only made more complex in the way that people behave towards one another and you know, how their perception of all these events. So, kind of, Rachel puts it on Jacob, then Jacob says, who am I? You know, I have no control over the situation. And that's when she takes matters into her own hands, which is not the first time we've seen this sort of scenario play out. You know, she gives her servant to Jacob, her servant does bear children, and Rachel feels vindicated by this. In fact, she says that, you know, she seems to make that statement to God in verse 6, God has vindicated me, and has indeed heard my voice and has given me a son, which is weird because just the way, you know, again, I think this is, you know, culturally accepted. Today, I don't think we would necessarily see it that way, although people do use kind of similar means when they can't bear children. But it's just interesting that she was pleased by this. To me, later on, we're going to see that, you know, the circumstances change a bit with the significance of here later in this chapter, we'll see of a son that is born to her. But okay. Yeah, for sure. You know, it's our attitude towards things is significant, not just in the fact that we might have a bad attitude for something, but our attitude towards things affects how we actually behave. Willie, your point, I think, is well taken in that, you know, respect, is that, you know, her attitude then steered the direction in which she actually behaved towards her husband. One, and, you know, the question, the comments, you know, the statement that she makes to him, and the attitude with which I think she probably made it, but then also in the attitude in which she treated her maidservant, and she treated her sister, and she treated her husband, and just how that, you know, became a, you know, somewhat toxic, I would say, just in the way their family engaged. But JJ,
to go off of Willie's point, oftentimes that attitude, even, you know, when you get in a bad mindset, that doesn't necessarily change when the circumstances improve, and that's obvious in verse 8 because she has this bad mindset. She's not only jealous, but like Hercules said, very envious here. Mm-hmm. And even after that, and we have some positivity here, as Dan is born, look at the comment that she makes in verse 8.
Right.
Then she says, with mighty wrestlings, I have wrestled with my sister and have prevailed.
Mm-hmm.
That's a super positive attitude to have. Obviously, I'm being facetious. So, you know, the attitude was still there. The looking and comparing was very much still there, even though the circumstances for her mm-hmm. and her mind had improved because there was now a son that was attached to her. She
right. Yeah, and her criteria for success were clearly probably misplaced, right? I mean, even if you were very simply counting, she still hasn't prevailed. I mean, it's just, you know, it's kind of all in her mind a little bit at this point. I can't begin to explain, but I can at least state this, and we'll see this a little bit later as Laban reenters the story, which is that it would be easy for us to really read this as a third party and just say, man, these people are incredible. And yet, if we're being honest, I think, with ourselves, what we would find is that the character traits that are repulsive really to us in this story, we probably share some of those things. Now, they may not have played out in our lives the way that we see it play out in this story, but I probably don't behave far too differently at times. I don't want to say that this is just who we are all the time, but I think that there are aspects of the story here that play out in our own lives, and by the way, we should be repulsed by that too. I say that because I know for me it can be a bad habit to read the Bible, to read these stories, to see how people behave, and to point the finger and forget that sometimes, you know, I display that sort of an attitude as well. And so it's important for us to be able to read these stories, to identify those things that we don't like, and then subsequently be able to identify it when we're heading down that same path, to be able to cut it off and make the necessary changes. So, what's the situation with Leah at this point?
It's clearly seen now as a competition by her as well.
Right.
And so she can't have more children, it looks like, but her servant can.
Mm-hmm.
And so more children.
Right. Yeah, more children. And you know, again, her attitude towards it. How fortunate. So she named him Gad. She's happy. So she names the second Asher that's born to her maid Zilpah. And then the story for me gets really weird, even a little awkward potentially. What's the next scene that we have? And you can paraphrase if you'd like.
Pay for favors from Jacob.
Yes, you know what's really weird to me is that there even needed to be this discussion, kind of this bargaining agreement, you know, between the two of them. That's what's kind of odd to me, is that Leah felt like she needed to make any sort of agreement. It's her husband. In fact, she is the first wife. And, you know, I say that very literally. And yet, what's the situation here? What does Rachel want that Leah's son, Reuben, has?
The mandrakes.
Now, there may be some significance to the fact that these are mandrakes, because it seems that there was some what we would call an aphrodisiac, right? There are certain qualities that Rachel, at this point, who has not naturally conceived a child for Jacob, would potentially find useful in you know, achieving that goal. So that there does seem to be some significance in that, you know, what it is that she wants. Beyond that, I don't know that there is anything more to the story than that. She just wants something, and Leah's, you know, for whatever reason, kind of put herself in the position where she thinks she has to negotiate here, which I don't think she really needs to, but that's the way the story plays out.
Well, I think one of the things that you see here is that Jacob, he's still in love with Rachel. He's not giving much time to Leah.
Yeah, and that's a good point, Will.
Yeah, Rachel has his love, but that's not enough for her.
Yeah.
Whereas if Leah would have had that,
yeah, that's a good thing.
Like, you can have something and that ain't enough for you. You gotta have something more. That's the original.
Yeah, so what Willie had said, if you couldn't hear, was that Leah might have felt like she just wasn't getting time with her husband, and this was the way to accomplish that, right? It was the kind of step in line of Rachel by making this sort of deal with her. And indeed, that happens. I don't know how Jacob's feeling in all this. The scriptures don't really go into great amount of detail. At the end of the day, it doesn't really matter. I mean, this is really just kind of in some sense, a blip in the bigger picture of things. But nonetheless, you know, Jacob comes in. Leah tells Jacob what's happened, the deal that she's made with Rachel, and so Leah has more children, naturally, with Jacob, and you know, again, she's ecstatic about her circumstances, not just sons at this point, but also a daughter, And the daughter will become significant in a few chapters ahead. We won't talk about it today. In a tragic story, and that's really going to get, you know, turned wild. So we'll talk more about Dinah. I don't actually know the proper pronunciation, but I'd imagine you can go with either. And then we get to the final kind of section here. What we're going to find, these aren't the only children. We're going to see later in the story, and we alluded to it on Wednesday, there is actually another child that comes into play, and you probably already know that because there's a name that hasn't been mentioned so far in this chapter that will come about later. So Rachel does finally conceive a child. Who is it? How does it come about?
Joseph,
right. Yeah, how could you forget Joseph? Joseph is probably, in the near term, going to be one of the more significant characters within the story, you know, for obvious reasons. Which again, you know, we're talking about this, placing that significance on Judah and the fact that he was one of the original sons of Jacob's first wife, Leah. I think there is some significance in the fact that Joseph, who was naturally born to Rachel, is also going to have significance within the story. And we'll see that play out, you know, a little bit later on in the book of Genesis. So we're going to see all that happen. But I think there's something else that I want to touch on here, just given what we just talked about with Rachel desiring the mandrakes. So how did this happen? Was it the mandrakes? It was God. Right. And I don't think that's of, you know, inconsequential that the scriptures mention that, right? So we're not left concluding that, oh, the mandrakes must have some, you know, particular, you know, medicinal, you know, qualities that allowed for Rachel to finally conceive. No. In the same way that, as we get into the story later here in a moment, I would not recommend if you wanted to, you know, raise flocks of sheep that you go out and try and do what Jacob does, because you're probably going to fail miserably. First, if you could even recreate what Jacob does, good luck with that. But let's say you could. I don't know that that's going to work out in your favor the way that we're going to see it play out for Jacob. And for me, the very simple reason being that this is really God at work. This has nothing to do with mandrakes or Jacob being an expert, shepherd, or, you know, somehow he has, you know, he just has the supernatural ability to breed, you know, flocks of livestock. I don't think it has anything to do with that. Jacob was probably pretty good out in the field, but I don't think it was that good. And I think that's where we're going to see 31 come into play, and Jacob acknowledges it for himself. We'll get to that here in a moment, hopefully. All right, so the last part of this chapter, you might have it titled within your chapter, Jacob Prospers. And really, that's how I'd characterize this whole chapter, quite honestly, is really God establishing the household of Jacob, right? Which is ultimately going to become God's people. I mean, this is really the foundations for that, right? So there's significance in that. There's significance in the prosperity that Jacob achieves because God promised that God, Jacob, that God would be with him, right? And I think that this is an element of that, that God is going to make Jacob what I'll term independently wealthy, in the sense that God is going to establish Jacob and allow him to go off and be incredible on his own as a household, which will then go on to establish his people. And we see that play out here in maybe a more literal sense, beyond just kind of the children that are born to Jacob that will comprise the household of God, but rather what we see happen in these last chapters are what? First, Jacob realizes something and asks Laban to do him a favor, essentially, which is what?
To go back home and think of stuff.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting. I don't know when Isaac and Rebekah sent Jacob away what they had in mind in terms of how long he would go. I think the impression that I was left with as we were going through that was it was meant to be some period of time, but I don't know that it was meant to be what will become 20 years. I don't know that that was ever anticipated. So it's interesting. At this point, though, Jacob has his wives and a lot of sons. He needs his space, and he needs to go home, by the way. And we know that because there is significance when he left, and he had that vision in Bethel. He left the rock as a monument. And we know that at that point, Jacob had already agreed that he was going to come back, right? And by the way, God had promised him that land, so he had to come back anyways to take it. Now, what we know is that he himself won't take it, but his descendants will, and they need to be in the area, in the land, to do that. So there is the intention that he would come back, and that's what Jacob is asking of Laban. How does Laban feel about this? Not ready? Yeah, that's you're giving Laban a lot of credit. I don't know that Laban would ever be ready.
He considered Jacob cheap labor,
apparently. He
cheated him,
right?
In everything.
Yeah, he was.
I don't think he wanted to lose him. And then his daughters, he would be taking his daughters and grandchildren. And,
right.
You know, I would hate that.
Yeah, I mean, you make some very good comments and interesting points. The fact that Jacob would be taking his daughters. Jacob was cheap labor. All those things, I think, are probably fair to say. But what does Laban actually say? What is actually quoted from Laban within this? What is his reason?
That God had prospered him since Jacob had been there.
God had blessed me on your account. And so while the implication might be all those things that we just talked about, what Laban sees is that, man, my farm, I'm terming it that, has really done well since you showed up, Jacob. And yes, it was probably because Jacob was good at that. It was also likely because God had blessed Laban because he had taken Jacob in, and we know that God was going to bless those who blessed him. So it could have very well been that, Laban being blessed by extension or in a way to bless Jacob. You know, all these things are true, but Laban seems to be having looked at this very selfishly, the arrangement here, and not looked at it for what it is, which is God blessed Laban, yes, but only in effect to bless Jacob, not to bless Laban for the sake of Laban. And that seems to be something that's just kind of gone by Laban. You know, I would argue that the attitude that Laban takes here is probably not too different from our own in the sense that we can be selfish from time to time. We can do things with selfish motives. We can have selfish reasons for why we want people to do something. I think about this is making it kind of a stretch a little bit. But I know, like, for instance, Cindy's sister who lives out in California, and she has, I mean, that's her home, basically, and she's very good friends with several of the people there within the church. And they're going to be relocating her and her husband to Ohio. And I know several of those families and her friends there that are close to her within the church don't want her to leave. But I would argue they don't want her to leave for selfish reasons. They don't want to leave because they had a friendship and they don't want her to go away and that maybe spoil that friendship. And I don't mean that in a derogatory sense, but just the fact that they'll be distant, separating them. And I would argue that's not a good reason for why you don't want somebody to leave. Now, if you thought that them leaving would put their spirituality in peril, then I would say, absolutely, by all means, try to step in if you can, if you think that they're going down a path that's going to separate them from God, not from you. You can overcome the distance if you really want to. Now, I would say those would be good reasons. The reasons that I've heard expressed, not the best reasons, but I understand it. You know, we don't want to lose friends. You enjoy those relationships. And I would argue here that Laban's motivations for why he doesn't want Jacob to leave are not because it's the right thing for Jacob, because Laban sees it as the right thing for him if he doesn't. If Jacob goes, then who's going to care for his flocks the way that Jacob has that's allowed Laban to prosper? All right, so what is the deal then that Jacob makes with Laban? Oh, sorry, Shannon, you've had your hand up,
yeah.
Sorry.
So I think it's that interesting statement that David makes there after he says that and acknowledges that. And you have to wonder what Jacob was thinking when he said it. Name your wages, and I'll give it. And this is a guy that, can you trust him?
Mm-hmm.
Can you trust him? Probably not.
Right.
Probably not. So he says this, and then you know, go into it, and Jacob says, "You yourself know how I served you, and how your livestock is fair." But I just, you know, Jacob's thinking, how am I going to get out of this?
Mm-hmm. Right. So you mentioning that reminds me, and I'll just allude to it now, lest I forget, which is in Genesis 31, verse 41. Jacob tells this to Laban. These 20 years I have been in your house. That's how I knew it was 20 years, not because I was a math genius. Jacob says so. I have been in your house 20 years. I served you 14 for your two daughters. We knew that. And 6 years for your flock, which was not, I think, as well known at this point. And you changed my wages 10 times. 10 times. So clearly we don't have the entire story because I don't recall him going. We've not gone through 10 scenarios in which Laban has switched up the rules on Jacob. We certainly saw it in the instance where between Leah and Rachel, but we haven't seen all those other times that this occurred apparently throughout.
Is he exaggerating it to make a point, or was it actually 10 times? I would think it was probably 10 times.
I was going to say it might have been an exaggeration, but maybe only an exaggeration because it was actually 8. I don't know. You know, it was. I think the point being that Jacob has realized that Laban has dealt dishonestly with him, right? And indeed, God recognizes that as well. We'll see that play out in chapter 31 as well, which is why God tells Jacob. So when Jacob asks, God ultimately is going to come to him in the 31st chapter and tell him, you need to go back home, right? So, which I think is important to the story, but we can talk about that next week.
Well, what I find interesting in the life of Jacob is he seems to be treated in his life the way he has treated other people. Mm. And it makes me wonder if God allowed him to go this long being mistreated so that he could wake up and see how bad he had been. Because he needs to change his attitude if he really wants to serve God and bring this great nation through his descendants. He needs them to keep God in mind and serve God.
Right.
And he's been really bad.
I can't disagree with that statement. Jacob has done some bad things to his brother, of all people. And so it's interesting. You know, I've thought about that myself. I think 31 is going to be enlightening in this respect because I don't know that these things happened to Jacob as punishment. I think it would be easy for us to interpret it that way. But the way that God seems to interpret the circumstances is actually that Laban was just treating Jacob bad because that's what Laban does. And we talked about that. That sort of behavior seems to be just a character or family trait. It's the way Rebecca treated her own husband by deceiving him to favor her son, her beloved son. we see it play out here, obviously, between Laban and Jacob. But it seems that God recognizes that Laban didn't deal honestly with Jacob, and that's why God is telling him, go, and I'm going to bless you, right? I'm going to be with you. Just to, again, I think, reiterate the promise he's already made. And I think that is significant. And, you know, again, I would also come back to what we talked about previously, which is when Jacob has that epiphany, I'll call it an epiphany, on the way, and he realizes that the God's in the land, that really does, for me, seem to be a milestone, an important point within Jacob's life that he really may not have come to terms with up until that point, but from that point onward, does seem to deal with things differently than he had in the past. And so while we certainly don't have all the details, for instance, we just talked about, we haven't seen all the 10 times that Laban, you know, changed up the arrangement with Jacob. There are a lot of details that we miss from these stories. The things that are brought forward for us do seem to indicate that there was a change in attitude. It's not to say that Jacob was perfect, but seems to have, you know, righted the ship to some degree. All right, Shannon, I think, and then Willie.
Yeah, and you kind of made some of the points that I was going to, and I think, you know, that change in behavior. What we don't see Jacob doing is trying to take things into his own hands, which maybe he would have if he didn't have some trust in God. The other thing is we, and maybe part of that is, we don't see him retaliate against Laban. He treats Laban, knowing full well that he cannot be trusted. He still deals honestly with Laban, which is quite commendable, because who wouldn't be frustrated after 10 years or after 15 years, and certainly after 20 years?
Mm-hmm. Right. Really?
I think one of the lessons that we can get out of it is that God can prosper you no matter how you've been treated. And it's a shame that even in our country, there are large part of citizenship. But anyway, you're told you can't make it because these other ones are trying to hold you down.
Right.
And it's a shame. It's just that and I think for us, of course, just tell people, you know, serve God, and God will prosper you. You don't have to worry about what the other person
does. Yeah, the first question to ask is, what does it mean to make it? Right? Make it by the world's terms? Maybe. Make it in God's terms? There's nobody holding you back but yourself. So, I know we're at time. We haven't talked about these remaining verses. For me, and I guess I'll just open up the floor for maybe last comments here as it relates to what Jacob goes on to do. I agree, Shannon. I don't think Jacob deals dishonestly with Laban. In fact, I think in some sense, Laban thought he was getting one over on Jacob, quite honestly, in this arrangement. Jacob says what to Laban? Jacob says, I will keep your flocks, but you need to do this one thing for me, which is what? What's Laban going to give in exchange for Jacob's labor in these final years?
Dismantled and spotted his
trails. That's right. Now, what does that really mean, I think, from Laban's perspective?
Genetically, that's not very many.
All right. It's one. It's not going to likely be very many.
Yeah, he's happy to give him that because that's not asking a whole lot.
And what's the other aspect of it? It's not just that it's not very many. Probably also the ones that Laban doesn't really want anyways, because they're probably not worth as much, whatever that might mean. I think some of it is just the perception that if they are not, you know, purely white sheep, that they are, you know, inferior. But what Jacob's going to go and do is take what Laban views as being lesser sheep and become strong with them. And that's... what's interesting is that this whole scheme that he devises, which I can't even begin to describe, is he's actually going to breed more of these lesser sheep, let's say, right? All the spotted, the speckled, and in time, he's going to develop for himself a pretty large flock by doing this time after time after time. And ultimately, that's where 31 is going to pick up, where Laban's sons are saying, Jacob's went and stole all of our dad's stuff. And the reality is he's not done any of that. And again, I think it's really God's providence in the story here. I don't think this is a story that demonstrates how much of an expert breeder Jacob was. He was probably good. He wasn't that good. It's really to demonstrate that God was active within the story. Despite everything that we see people doing to one another, God was still here. He was still present. And, you know, I'll leave you, I guess, with that this morning before we close, which is, we talked about it, actually the comment was made to me last Sunday. I talked about it again Wednesday after services, but I'll mention this because I think it's relevant at all times, but I think it's particularly relevant here just to point us back to that point. The statement that Joseph makes to his brothers when they come back to Egypt, and, you know, their perception is that, man, Joseph's going to hate us for this. And what does Joseph tell them? That while they may have meant their actions for evil, God meant it for good. And I think that, you know, despite how people are treating one another here and their motivation or the intention behind their actions, which I think in many cases probably wasn't pure, God, while they might have meant it for evil, God meant it for good. While they might have had selfish ambitions, God meant it for good. And we see that play out, that, you know, mankind is not going to get in the way of God executing his plan the way that God intended. And we'll see that play through. So that's just to remind us that God is indeed, you know, while we may not be able to see that staircase, that ladder, it's there. Believe it. God's active. While the world around us might seem the worst intention, at the end of the day, God will make it for our benefit. He will bless us. In the same way that Jacob had to endure a lot with his relationship with Laban, but ultimately God's going to bless him for it. And really, I think there are lessons for us to be learned in that. All right, so we'll close there for today, and then, you know, hopefully, if not, that's fine. You know, I'm fine to pick this up again on Wednesday if we need to, but I hope the tools do get well soon. But we will pick up with chapter 31 on Wednesday. Plan to do that. Again, plan to read. As you notice, I tend not to read because there's just so much to talk about. So plan to do that. So I would definitely recommend, if you haven't already read several chapters ahead, do that, because you get a lot of the context that's helpful when you read these stories just in isolation to understand if you don't recall. some of these stories.